In 3, 2, 1.
Emotional intelligence, EI, often referred to as EQ or emotional quotient, is critically important in our professional lives and workplace for a multitude of reasons. Its impact ranges from individual performance to organizational culture and even to the bottom line of the business. In the digital age, where technology and automation are prevalent, the human element of business becomes increasingly valuable. Emotional intelligence nurtures this human element, fostering environments where creativity, innovation, and productivity thrive. Whether it's through leadership, teamwork, customer interaction, or adaptability, the importance of emotional intelligence in the workplace cannot be overstated. It's an investment in people that pays dividends in organizational success and sustainability. To help us understand how EI and AI can complement each other in promoting a culture of inclusion is my guest, author, speaker, and coach, Teresa Worthy. Well, hi, Teresa. Welcome to the program. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, where are we speaking to you from today?
I'm in metropolitan Atlanta. I live in a town called Powder Springs, which I'm sure most people have never heard of, but it's just outside Marietta, Georgia. Some people have heard of Marietta because of Lockheed Martin. And of course, I'm only 25 to 30 miles from Atlanta, depending on traffic, which route I have to take to avoid traffic.
Atlanta's a lovely town. You've got a good sports town, lots of great restaurants, and people are great. I always love it when I get to go to Georgia and all over Georgia. So good people in the South. And like I say, it's always a pleasure to be able to go speak or work there. Delighted for you to share some time with us today. And I'm excited about our topic because we're going to be talking about self-awareness, emotional intelligence, change readiness, and how to do this. And as an author and a speaker and a coach and a facilitator in workshops, you've had some great experience at this. So I want to share some of those strategies with our listeners and why that's important and how, as we build our businesses, whether we're working internally or we have our own companies, what can we do to use today's technologies and how do we make our organizations and our cultures more effective and better places to work? Because as you know, there's shortages of employees, companies are trying to get employees. So culture, it really does become a major factor in the decision-making. But before we get there though, let's talk about how Teresa became Teresa. So let's go back. You're going to school and you have a choice of careers and you decide, hey, I think I'm going to enter the EI zone. Like, how did we get here?
Well, to begin where I need to begin, like Charles Dickens says, I'd like to say that I was born. And I was born and grew up in the segregated South. So my high school was predominantly Black, well, all Black, because there was no integration at the time. And during that time, my sister and I, they're just the two of us, we weren't taught to feel badly about our circumstance. We were just told that, you know, this is just how it is. And if you want to get out of this, if you want to rise above this or transcend, if you will, you need your education. And I can remember at a very young age being frightened of white people. And it was because of the stories that, you know, that were bouncing around in my community about things that were happening to Black men, mostly because the Ku Klux Klan was rather rampant during those times.
Yeah, big.
I just had this of white people, but I never had what you'd call a hate for them, just a fear. I always felt like white people will kill me and I don't understand why. And my mother said it has a lot to do with the color of your skin, but that's not your problem because you didn't choose to be born your color. They didn't choose to be born the color that they are. What you need to concentrate on is getting your education. So she read to us a lot. And she just insisted that we do the best we could in school. And so because I didn't want to go to school, I decided that I'll go to school and I'll make the most of it while I'm here. And what I began to do was watch my teachers. And I emulated my teachers. I'd go home and I'd play school. And that set up that desire in me to become a teacher. So that's what I did. When I graduated high school, I went on to college to become a teacher. And I taught French. I taught French until, well, I started out working for a bank because I knew once I had children, I wouldn't work. And so when the children came, I was a full-time mom. And then once my youngest entered high school, I went to teach. I first started working on my master's and at the same time took that job as a teacher. And I loved teaching. I just enjoyed it so much because I'd become an empty nester just all of a sudden because my children were born close together. So there they were, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. And I had no children. They didn't need me anymore. And I just fell in love with my students. Because I taught French, I was exposed to different nationalities, of course, different cultures, because the students who studied French came from all different backgrounds. Occasionally, I'd have native speakers in my class. So that was fun. And then I retired. Once I retired, I wanted to write a book. And I did write a book, my first nonfiction book. And then I went on to writing fiction novels. But in the interim, I started going to Toastmasters International. And I found that I enjoyed speaking to crowds or speaking to audiences. And so I started then having seminars and workshops for people who wanted to write and publish their own books. And that gave me more confidence in my speaking ability. And ultimately, I joined the National Speakers Association. And in doing so, I learned that I needed to have a focus area, if you will. And I thought, well, what am I passionate about? And the one thing that came to mind first was inclusion. I know people clump it together, diversity, equity, inclusion, but most people confuse diversity with inclusion, and they are two separate things. Hmm. It's sort of like this woman says, she has this definition for it. She said, diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion means being asked to dance. So I thought, I want to
focus on
inclusion, because it doesn't matter what color your skin is, if you will. And I keep coming back to that because of this society that we live in here in the United States. We're like a black and white society. We focus on color. We focus on race. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter what your race is. You can all be of the same race and still be excluded from things. So everybody has a need to be included. And then that inclusion topic led me over to becoming self-aware, so much so that I did an independent study on self-awareness, finding out how many people are actually self-aware. And as it turns out, they're only about 15% of the population is truly self-aware. And then that self-awareness, I learned, is the cornerstone of emotional intelligence. So then I started studying Daniel Goleman program, and I realized that emotional intelligence has five components. And the key component, the number one component, is self-awareness. So in order to be more inclusive, people, first of all, need to develop self-awareness and at the same time, develop emotional intelligence, which is being able to recognize, understand, and manage your own emotions, which then it allows you then to recognize, interpret or understand, and then respond appropriately to the emotions of others. So all those three things just sort of came together. And I thought, this is where I belong, because I'm so passionate, first of all, about inclusion, and then learning how important self-awareness is to emotional intelligence. I realized that I've been practicing emotional intelligence my entire marriage, if you will, and in raising my three children, because those two things, and of course, emotional intelligence is really about relationships. We're all in the relationship business. So I'm wanted to have a strong relationship in my marriage, and I needed a strong relationship with my children, and that required emotional intelligence. And I realized that it is not an overnight thing. You don't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to be so emotionally intelligent. You have to practice it. So that's how I got here.
That's interesting. Well, you raised a couple of interesting points. So you say about 15% of the population is emotionally aware. And
no, self-aware.
Or self-aware. And then they, thank you. And that's a subset, the total emotional intelligence umbrella. So if we're defining it, self-awareness is how am I showing up in all of this, right? How do we develop that self-awareness? And how do we develop that emotional intelligence?
Okay, so emotional intelligence has five basic components. There's self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, social skills, and motivation. And you develop emotional intelligence by navigating through those five basic components, beginning with self-awareness, because self-awareness is the ability to understand your actions and your thoughts and your feelings. And notice that I use the word feeling here as opposed to emotion. Although we use those two words interchangeably, they are different. Feelings, emotions are brief, but feelings can last a long time and get angry, and just experience that anger for a minute, depending on your emotional intelligence level. But if that anger is combined with what you feel is egregious hurt or pain, you hold on to that anger until you learn through emotional intelligence training how to get rid of that anger and replace it with something else. So self-awareness then is, first of all, understanding your thoughts, your feelings, and your behaviors. And then once you are able to do that, not only your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, your strengths, your weaknesses, what you value, what your beliefs are, that's just having a firm, grounded understanding of who you are and what you believe. And in getting to that point, when you dive deep into it, you learn that most of what we all carry is from experiences and events in the past. And when you realize that, when you truly realize it, you can find yourself in a situation today and it can bring all sorts of feelings. And then you remind yourself, this is sort of like when this happened to me in 1970, but this is not 1970. This is a different time. So this is not how I need to behave today because this is a different situation. Now, all of this can happen in just a few seconds once you practice replacing negative thoughts, behaviors, and feelings with more positive ones. And that's why I say emotional intelligence is a skill. It requires practice.
Interesting. And we're all starting at a different point.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's interesting how your perspective shapes what we go into and how we choose our therapy or pathology of, for instance, my parents. I was fortunate. I had a different perspective. My father was a musician, so I had a very diverse growing up, moved around a lot. I was always the one that was fighting for inclusion because I was always the new kid in the class. He was in the service. Every year I was in a new school. It was trying to belong, right? It was just trying to belong. And that's just me as a white kid. You start adding other factors into it, and all of a sudden it can become challenging. I grew up in the 60s and 70s as well. So I remember white women got the right to vote in 1920, black men in 1964. So I was already on the planet. It's like, really? We're not that far back here. We're talking in my lifespan. Yeah. And, you know, and what happens is we look at other countries and we've evolved as a country, and we still have a long way to go. In US, Canada, every country is evolved at a different level, I think. But it's really about that communication. And a lot of it's, like you said, fear-based. People are fearful. They're maybe ignorant in some places. And once they learn a little more, then it's different. It's like in Canada, we had same-sex marriage 20 plus years ago. And then I remember when it came to the United States, everybody's worried the dissolve of the family. And we're like, yeah, no, it's actually works pretty good. People can do their own thing and have their own families. And once we learn to accept that versus being scared of it, instead of being scared of it. And I think it makes for a better culture within our societies and within our organizations. You definitely got your work cut out for you. How's it going? How's the battle going? Like right now, you talked about breaking up diversity, equity, and inclusion. DEI itself is under political attack, as you know, you've seen it. Is inclusion as well? Are we seeing EI? Do you find that an upward battle as well within organizations?
Not so much with inclusion, because as I said, if you really look at inclusion, it has nothing to do with race or gender, to do with differences. And we're all different. You know, every one of us is different. You'll have some organizations where there are a lot of people from Ivy League schools and some people who are not. Right. And they find themselves being excluded because they're not from an Ivy League school. And yet they're just as educated. They have their degrees, sometimes even more so. You know, they're more so innovative and intelligent. But they find themselves being excluded or discriminated against. And it's just because of who we are. It's human nature, I think. We're tribal by nature.
Yeah, very tribal.
So we want to navigate towards people who are like us. But we find that when we navigate towards people who on the surface look like us, we're still going to encounter differences. Because let's say they look just like me, but they have a different religion, or they don't think you should give your child an immunization. But does that mean that I have to ignore them or exclude them from any conversations or avoid them in any way because they're different? They have a different belief system than I do. Oh, you're still a human being when it all comes down to it. And we learned how human we all are right after 9/11. And I know you were probably in Canada, but here people were sticking together after 9/11, sticking together. Everybody was scared. The one thing that we did that we shouldn't have done was we showed clear bias towards those people who looked, you know, who looked Middle Eastern. And there was no call for that. But because of the fear inside in us, because of that attack, we all stuck together as Americans. And then we united almost against people from that area. And that wasn't a good thing at all. Yeah. And I'm guilty of that myself. I can remember one day I pulled through the drive-thru to get a prescription fill. And I know that often we would have guests, if you will, or visiting pharmacists. And so the person who came to the window was not my regular pharmacist. So I thought, oh, there's a mistake. This person must have come to the window by mistake. And the person was of a Middle Eastern background. And I got scared. And I had to tell myself, remind myself, what are you doing? Are you doing? So I put on my biggest smile and I, you know, asked how they were doing. We started a conversation. I've learned that my regular pharmacist was out ill for the day. And this person was perfectly qualified to give me my prescription and even gave me a bit of medical advice that I've never had before. So inclusion is something that we all need to concentrate on. We all need to concentrate on behaving inclusively, because we can unconsciously exclude people.
So does education help us with being aware that we might have those internal biases? Because those things are going to be embedded in our amygdala, right? Like if we've had experience, it gets embedded where if all of a sudden you had a previous experience, you're going, hey, and it's in there. How do we then recognize it within that it's an embedded experience, that it was an isolated embedded experience? So it probably wouldn't happen again. It can happen with anybody, anytime, anywhere, right? Any location. So those things happen, but they do shape our things. And how do we unwind that feeling, if you will? How do we unwind that thinking so that we can then overcome it?
We unwind it. I'll tell you how it happened for me. And it comes through training. And as you said, it comes through education, because I had to learn how the brain works. And you mentioned the amygdala. The amygdala is just a tiny portion of our brain, almond shaped, small, but it is almost fully developed. It's 80% developed even in an infant, because infants immediately begin to experience emotions. And that tiny little amygdala holds on to all of those emotions. Even though an infant can't put a name to them, they hold on to them every encounter. They also hold on to memories there. Memories are lodged in the amygdala. We always say that it's in control of the fight or flight mode, but it helps us to determine whether or not an experience, a person, an event, whether it's threatening or if it's okay to proceed, if you will. And so once you learn that all of that is stored in your amygdala since infanthood,
you
can't help but realize I'm not responsible for this sort of thinking today coming from something that happened to me in my past. When you understand that, like I said, it's a time-consuming process. It takes time. It doesn't happen overnight. You begin to get to a point where you can talk to yourself. You can talk yourself through an incident by saying, wait, this is not then. This happened before. So I don't respond the same way I would have responded then, because this is not then. Today, I'm determined to behave inclusively. Today, I'm determined to manage my own emotions. And I recognize my own triggers. I know what's triggering me if I'm suddenly angry, because if I see somebody who reminds me of something bad that happened in my past that made me angry, then I know that's not that person right now. No need to be angry. Replace that anger immediately with something more pleasant, even if it's just a smiling, hi, how are you?
Right. It's a reprogramming though, isn't it? If you've had experiences that shaped it, how do we unwind that? It does take some careful training, almost like bad habits, isn't it?
Yes. And you've heard of Og Mandino. He wrote.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
One of his quotes is, only a habit can subdue another habit. And that's where you get into forming a new habit to replace an old habit. And you can't do it unless you have a desire to do so. You have to first realize, this is not who I want to be. This is not how I want to behave. This is not how I want to think. This is not working for me. I need to do something else. And then when you get that mindset, then you're able to move forward. But once you are satisfied with your behavior and your method of thinking and your feelings, there you go.
This episode is sponsored in part by Rainmaker Digital Solutions, featuring ActiveCampaign. Looking to drive growth with customer experience automation? ActiveCampaign, the number one marketing automation platform for e-commerce, B2C and B2B companies, gives you the email marketing, marketing automation, and CRM tools you need to create incredible customer experiences. ActiveCampaign is the platform we use to reach, nurture, convert, and grow our business, and you can use it to grow yours. You can see why 150,000 plus businesses like yours choose ActiveCampaign to help them grow and become preferred in the markets they serve. You can also start your free trial by visiting our website and clicking on the ActiveCampaign trial link. As a bonus, we'll also give you a digital copy of my book, Becoming Preferred, How to Outsell the Competition. And in the interest of full disclosure, I am a shareholder in the company. And now back to my conversation with Teresa Worthy. How have you seen the exclusivity? Because you've been teaching this to corporations, individuals, companies that are starting up. How transformative can the adoption of this kind of philosophy and inclusion policy, if you will, I don't want to use the word policy, but just an attitude of inclusion. When you go in and do your work, where have you seen companies transform with that? In other words, prior to Teresa coming in to post Teresa, been working with our teams, what do you see?
I get these reports because I like to send back post assessments as well. I find out that employees are becoming better adept at managing conflict. They're also becoming more adept at working together, at collaborating together, and more adept at handling customer service and customer relations, because they're learning, or they've learned, that if I can manage my emotions, if I recognize my own triggers and I recognize my own emotions, I can see that in others. And because I know how that feels, I'm going to put myself in their shoes. And I'm going to respond in a way that I would like for someone to respond to me when I'm feeling that way, or when I'm going through things like that. When they begin to improve.
You teach that. You teach empathy as well.
I do them in workshop settings. And the workshop settings are interactive. I'm a fan of experiential learning. So I give them case studies, real life scenarios, and they do role play. They do group work where they have to come up with a common project or solve a common problem. And it lets them have hands-on experiences in collaborating, in conflict resolution, and in establishing and beginning to form a stronger relationship among themselves. And so they leave there still in that sort of framework or mindset. They also leave with a workbook. And as I said, in my post-assessments, I check back periodically, how are things going? And when there's an issue, sometimes I'll do one-on-one coaching, especially if there's someone who's experiencing very strong difficulty with, I can't, my boss.
Yeah, no kidding.
I work with them. I have 30-day journal prompts that I give them to help them write out, what are you feeling right now? How do you feel when this happens? How do you respond when you're in the right? You know, you don't want to create a conflict. How do you respond? And in doing that daily writing, following those prompts, they begin to get a glimpse, a real true glimpse inside and who they are and these emotions they're experiencing. And they begin to understand them. And as long as they have that crutch to fall back on, that crutch of the tiny amygdala, it's almost refreshing to know, you know?
Well, it's changing because with organizations, you know, prior to the pandemic, we had one group of issues. During the pandemic, now people want to remote work. They don't want to go to work. We've got five generations of workers out there. So for instance, I'm baby boomer. Do you find that evolution of consciousness is better with the younger people today and more aware today than us, you know, older guys? Or what do you see? Like I work at emotional intelligence. I think it's important, but I didn't always have it. I had to recognize it, and between my wife and daughters and family, evolve into it, right? And get exposed to it. Still learning. But do you find that there's some generations that are just, they got it? And hey, we should be looking forward to them as the leaders and examples?
I think everybody has it. No one has perfected it. No, because we didn't have a term for it. Daniel Goleman sort of introduced or followed up on and did more study on the term emotional intelligence. We all are emotional individuals.
Right.
That doesn't mean that we're all capable of managing and understanding our emotions. And that's where emotional intelligence comes into play. I don't think the age group really matters. I really don't. I think every age group, all we need to do is find a way to relate to each other. I do it with music. because even at this age, like you, I'm a baby boomer, but I still like music and I still know popular songs. You know, I know hits.
Yeah, and with that. You're staying with that. Yeah. Usher did a great job at the Super Bowl. Sure. Or, hey, I love Pink or Lady Gaga or Taylor Swift. Or it's staying up on all of it, isn't it?
Or Usher or Beyonce.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful.
Or the Chinese singers who don't sing anymore. Smooth like butter. They sing that song.
Right.
I can't think of their names. But anyway, yeah, I keep up with music. I like it. So I'm able to do it to the younger people. And of course, I taught high school and middle school. So I sort of still remember how they think. And because I stayed home with my children, and I was introduced to every age level back to back. The time when I felt like I enjoyed younger people more than I enjoyed people my own age. I felt like I don't have them away.
I hear you on that one. Yeah, I find the younger generations very much, the people we hang out with are very much aware, and our kids are aware, and they're still schooling me on things, right? I've been learning about intent and impact. I've said things in the past or to family members or whatever where I'm no bad intention, but the impact was negative or not a result I'm looking for. So it's looking at it from that perspective and going, oh man, I screwed. Oh, I could see where that could get taken wrong. So it really is a lot of self-reflection and maturing maybe, because it's not a natural thing. I don't think we're born with this at all, but we are born with the capacity to grow it. But it's like a muscle, right?
Yeah, we're born with emotions. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
But managing them.
We have to learn how to understand them and manage them and even label them. Because like I said, a little baby cries head off. That's emotion personified. But he doesn't know why. He or she doesn't know why. He can't tell you why. And you can't figure out why. And everybody's in emotional turmoil because the baby's crying. Babies experience emotions. They're just experiencing them. They're letting them run.
Yeah.
Right. We aren't born with the ability to manage our emotions. We do have to learn how to do it and how to label them. That's also important because we need to know how to call fear, fear, and anger, anger, and hate, hate, and love, love, and happiness, happiness. Most of us have no problem with happiness and joy. You know, we know that. We know
how. We like that one, yeah.
Yeah, we can say, I'm happy. But, you know, someone says, oh, you look sad. Oh, I'm not sad. I'm just tired. When inside, you may be hurting from end to end, but you don't want to put a label on it to say I'm sad or I'm in grief. And that's what we need more practice with, naming those emotions and then feeling them. It's okay to feel them. That's why journaling is so good. When you feel them, write about them, describe them.
I found that a lot of the things I had to improve upon and still improving upon were what I saw modeled for me. And so what was modeled for me were my parents who came out of wartime. They were immigrants from England, wartime. They were modeled by their parents, and no one had a book on how to be a great parent. And those, you know, children should be seen and not heard, right? That was kind of the parenting style. So how important is that initial programming for us for the next generations? Because they're going to model what they see. If you saw your dad yelling and screaming every time he got mad or something, or your mom or doing whatever, you probably adopted that behavior unless you recognize it was inappropriate and there was other ways you could choose to react.
That is so true. And that comes, and not only is it modeled by parents, and that some of that behavior comes from generations back, because generation did the same thing 10 generations ago did.
Sense of bother.
Right. It's coming on. And so the escape and the freedom from that is recognizing that we're all influenced by past experiences, past beliefs, and past training, if you will. And most of the time, our first teachers are our parents, and they're only teaching what they know. They're teaching sometimes based on what they learned from their parents, who learned what they learned from their parents, who learned what they know from their parents. So you see it coming,
right.
Which explains racism. That's why racism is so continuous to permeate. Because it's coming down generation through generation. And some people don't even realize they're teaching it. They don't realize they're teaching it. I can remember my youngest daughter. They were taking piano lessons. And so they took piano lessons from a lady in a neighborhood. And so she'd have several students there at the time. And if we get there a little early, we'd do something, you know, to while away the time until it was time for them to go in. And so they were out in her yard playing. And a little neighbor child came over and walked up to my youngest daughter and said, I don't like you. I don't like. And he used the N-word. And so because of the way I try to teach my children, she said to him, you don't like me because you don't know me. if you get to know me, you'll really like me. That's good. And exactly. When you get to know someone, you find you have more in common sometimes than you do in differences. And then once you see that, and then once you can accept that this thinking that you have that makes you believe that you're a bit better than others comes from way back somewhere before, sometimes before you even knew. And that amygdala, if you will, continue to be responsible for that kind of thinking or that kind of behavior or those kinds of feelings. You replace them with something more positive. Because like you said, we're living in an age now where everybody seems to be a bit more enlightened, if you will. And so there are ways to get beyond that. But again, only if you find yourself not liking where you are can make that change. Because it does require change. It requires growth. That's the benefit of emotional intelligence training. You're put into a safe environment and you're allowed to just explore, to just share, to just experience emotions and thoughts and behaviors among peers, sometimes one-on-one. But as you begin to have those first experiences and then you walk away with a plan of dedicating each day to mindfulness, where you sit quietly and just reflect, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? How did I just behave? And just go through that quietly, just with yourself. You find yourself getting to better places. And as you continue to do it, it gets better.
It seems like it's a great place to be to, if you're suffering emotionally, if you're having any emotional suffering whatsoever, by processing that, as you just laid out, either reflective time, journaling, I am statement, well, however you want to do it, that quiet time, that you don't have to stay in a place of emotional suffering. You can actually get into where you're empathetic, and it's a freeing thing.
It is. Unless, of course, now there are some people who are actually suffering from emotional illness. And in that case, they need professional help. And there's nothing wrong with seeking professional help. Yeah. Because professional help gets you to a point where you can, you know, become better.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Your work emphasizes not just the individual benefits of EI, emotional intelligence, but also the impact on team dynamics within organizations and organizational success. Can you share a few insights on how emotionally intelligent teams and why this is important with teams contribute to innovation, customer service, ultimately profitability?
When you look at your teammate and you see a person there just like you, you've come to know them. You understand when they're angry. You understand because you know what it feels like to be angry. So you respond appropriately. You know, you don't find yourself getting offended, but you don't retaliate. You respond according to the way that person is showing you how they feel, and you recognize it. When you understand or empathize with another person, it sort of begins to strengthen your relationship. And when your relationships strengthen, you're able to collaborate with each other because you realize that this person is going to actively listen when I speak. And I'm going to do the same thing because that's a part of becoming emotionally intelligent is practicing active listening. I'm also going to support them in their ideas, even if they're different from mine, that's okay because this is a different person. And in doing so, supporting each other, you eventually come to a compromise. You come to a place where you can agree, a place of agreement, if you will. And then that makes it easier to continue to collaborate. You're feeling as if you belong. You don't feel like you're being excluded from anything. And then your bright ideas begin to flow. That's how you become more innovative because you feel comfortable. You feel safe with your teammates because everybody seems to understand each other. Everybody wants to work together. And team member B can have a great idea. And the other team members, knowing that this is someone I respect and who respects me and what they're saying makes sense, I can support this. I can work together with this person and we can get things done.
Yeah. How do you avoid or process the triggers? So I'm aware of what I'm aware of, and I know you are too, and whatever. But every once in a while, and usually only with those closest to us, so strangers, I don't care. It's an easy process. But with some loved ones or partners, man, they know how to push the buttons. I know which buttons to push. You know how to push a button. You can be instantly triggered and man, you're in it. And you don't want to. And you realize you got triggered and you realize you're going until you can process something a little different. Is there a way to put the brakes on? Like whenever you feel that's triggered, is there a way to? Because you move into a different place. It's that fight or flight, right? That lizard brain, that saber tooth is going by the cave. You want to grab the spear and go after it. Right. So when you get triggered in it, whether it's a colleague, a coworker, a child, you're moving along and all of a sudden you get yanked out of that conscious awareness state and the emotions are contagious and boom, you're in it. How do you get out of it? How do you get out of it quickly?
The quickest way is to take deep breaths. I'm taking yoga now, and so I'm learning the importance of breathing. If you can, in the midst of that, take a deep inhale and count to three, and then exhale and count to three, and do it again. You don't really have time to say anything because you're concentrating on breathing. Begins to give you a calm feeling. Then you can say something like, I think I'll go for a walk.
Ideally, yeah. Before you open your mouth, yeah.
If you open your mouth, yeah. You can always apologize. You can always say something like, look, I know you're angry. I'm angry. This is not a good time for us to talk right now because we're both angry. I want to take some time and reflect on my anger and so I can understand it. And I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just going to step aside from this. We can come back to it, but we don't have to continue this right now. And I'll go for a walk.
Yeah, we'll come back to it. We'll come back. Yeah, exactly.
Do your breathing. And I was just acknowledging that you've realized the other person is angry. It's good because it's like, well, he knows I'm angry. Well, that's good. He knows I'm angry.
That's funny.
We're going to come back. That's good. So if he's going to reflect, I'll reflect. I'll think about this.
No, it's good. I think, given your emphasis that you talk about on the importance of self-awareness and cultivating emotional intelligence, what are some of the maybe actionable strategies or exercises you recommend for individuals looking to enhance their self-awareness in both their personal and professional contexts?
Okay. So some of the skills that I recommend are, like I said, work on breathing. Breathing is important for life, but it is important because when you concentrate on breathing, and it takes like a few seconds, your mind goes somewhere else because it's concentrating on your breathing. That's one way. That's what mindfulness is about, just concentrating on your breath. And then as you do that, some thoughts may begin. You can either reflect on those thoughts or reject them, depending on how it makes you feel. Another way is, I keep mentioning journaling, exercise. I joked about taking a walk, but exercise is good. You need like a daily exercise program. And if it's just as simple as taking a walk, just a short, brisk walk, that's wonders. Another, what's very important, is when you get to a point where you recognize that certain events make you angry, take time to try to figure out, why is this a trigger? And once you can recognize why it's a trigger, the next time it appears, you'll recognize it. You will already have understood why it is. And then you will make a decision. Do I want to respond like I always respond because I see this trigger? Or do I want to do something different? Do I want to do something that keeps me at a place where I'm still calm and I'm able to manage my emotions? That's one. The other is to work on your verbal and your nonverbal skills, because the majority of communication is nonverbal, you know, with facial expressions, body language. Start paying attention to that. Pay attention. What am I doing with my face when I'm talking to others?
Right.
What am I doing with my hands? How's my body? Yeah. What am I doing? Am I like, yes, what am I doing? And then try to build rapport with people. And if it's as simple as a smile and a hello each time you see them. And if it's somebody who gets on your nerves, it's real important to try to get to the root of that. Why? Just a person.
Yeah. What's going on? Well, it's usually a reflection of ourselves, isn't it? In other words, if you do something that angers me, I'm more likely guilty of the same crime.
Exactly.
And that's so true. Yeah, my wife has an adage, when you're mad, you're wrong. And so if you get all bugged about that, it's because you're dealing with it. We don't like it in ourselves. We don't like it in others.
And we have not admitted that it's in ourselves.
Yeah.
That's
important. Well, here's the last question. Boy, time goes by fast. Looking towards the future, how do you envision the role of emotional intelligence evolving, especially as we continue to navigate the challenges and opportunities presented by AI, digital transformation? And what role do you see AI playing in supporting the development in the workplace?
A lot of people don't really understand it, but AI is a capability of even helping a person to understand their emotions. I don't know if, let's take ChatGPT, for example. If you were to simply type into ChatGPT, I am so angry right now. Please elaborate on the roots of anger. What is it that could possibly cause this anger in me right now? And use the word elaborate. ChatGPT will type you out a whole almost dissertation on the root of anger and what are some possible reasons as to why you may be feeling like you're feeling right now. And then once you, you know, read through it and you say, oh, I see, that's it. Then you can ask it, give me some examples of how I can respond appropriately in this situation. I can give you examples of appropriate responses. That's one way that it can help you.
Excellent. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah. When you're unable to formulate words to communicate what you're feeling, or you're unable to make the appropriate response, ask the AI system.
It's devoid of the emotions. You've already got that covered. You're getting a logical perspective, a left brain approach to it. That's excellent. What a great tip.
And when you get it, when you read it and or see it, it's going to strike a chord because you're receiving it. You're the emotional person. It's going to strike a chord.
You can't argue with it.
You can't argue with it.
Well, like you say, I think it's a subject matter. It's kind of like anything with health. You know, if you're adopting a healthier lifestyle, you have to start learning what's healthy, what isn't, what are my choices. And then it's really about making choices. And you talk about mindfulness. It's being present, really, in the moment.
And developing empathy. It's very important to be able to put yourself in another person's shoes.
Yeah.
Get there. Just get there and feel what they're feeling.
Do you find that gender-wise, that's more difficult? And this is a generalization, I realize that. But I would say my personal experience is I find that women are generally, or I won't just say women, those who are on the fringes or on the edges who have had different experiences are more mindful and more emotionally, I want to say emotionally intelligent or empathetic at least. Like I find them empathetic. Men, they're tough to be empathetic. I'm speaking from my own experience, I know a lot of women and I know a lot of women who are empathetic. I know people who are on the fringes of the different cultural groups. They seem very empathetic because, again, they've been fighting exclusion issues. And that's why I'm saying if you've come from that other side where you are excluded, I find them, they tend to be more empathetic to others.
Right. And the truth of the matter is everybody's been excluded from something.
Yeah.
It's just being able to remind yourself of that feeling when you were excluded. And then you can put yourself in the shoes of a person who at this very moment in your presence is feeling excluded because of something you said or did. And then a choice then. Do I want to be better and behave in a better manner where that I can resolve this issue of this person feeling excluded? Do I want to exhibit behavior that's inclusive? And if so, I need work. I need to do some work so that I'll do it so I can get rid of these thoughts and feelings that are coming forth from my amygdala years ago that are no longer current with what's happening right now. But really, empathy is very important. It's very important. And I hear what you're saying about women appearing to be more empathetic than men, but there are some men who do have empathy. There are some men who are able to put themselves in the shoes of others. And like I say, you'll find in my book, I talk about my marriage relationship a lot because I feel as though my husband lacks empathy. And so I have to have empathy and empathy for both of us.
Yeah, my wife does too. It's true. She'll empathy is, what is that exactly? It's okay. I have enough for both of us. But I'm finding as I get older that I am finding it more and more where I find by practicing it, you actually do feel empathetic. Like my wife will actually feel the emotion of it. And if you're crying, she's crying it. That's tougher for me.
It's tough. But if you begin to practice, the time when you cried.
Oh, yeah.
And you remember how it felt, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
That's how they're feeling when they cry. Did you get it?
Actually, not in the moment. You never like it in the moment, but you always feel better afterwards.
Right. And so then you know this person doesn't like that they're crying.
No, it's good.
And then it's like, and I feel that. I know what that was like. So I'm going to love.
Yeah. For me, I have to have experienced it almost to be more empathetic. If you hurt your broken arm and you went through it, then I'm like, oh, I totally know what that looks like. Oh, you blew your knee up. Oh man, I know what that's, that totally sucks. Or, you know, if somebody lost a loved one or I know what that looks like. So I can be empathetic. If I haven't experienced it, it's more of a challenge. So I have kind of, okay. True. So I'm normal that way. All right, good.
Yes, you're normal that way. But you do know sadness. You know what that feels like.
Yeah, right? I do. Yeah.
And you know what anger feels like? Maybe you didn't break a leg or a knee or whatever, but you put yourself in another person. So it just takes a little.
Just a little thinking and processing. I'm delighted after this interview that my EI quotient has gone up a couple of points. You know, maybe a couple of points higher, I'd be a plant.
But and so has mine. Mine has gone up too.
Well, it's bringing it to the awareness and it's talking about it because, like I say, we see so many things on the news and culturally where it isn't that. We don't have an empathetic culture. We do in certain segments, obviously, and the people, thank goodness, we're moving more that way. And I think as a nation, a country, we're getting better at that as people. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that happening. So that's a good evolution as well. But Teresa, this was terrific. You got a new project coming up. You have a new book coming up later in the spring.
I do. It's entitled Emotional Intelligence, the Underrated Superpower for Professional and Personal Growth. And in this book, I pay a lot or concentrate on 9 basic emotions that we all feel, no matter where we were born, in what part of the world, it doesn't matter. We've all experienced these 9 basic emotions. And from those emotions, those 9 basic emotions, I use case studies, I ask questions, I give activities where you actually have to write out answers to help bring you to a point where you can readily accept that if you want to achieve that higher level of emotional intelligence, you have to practice. And I give you tools and strategies to help you practice so that you do begin to experience personal and professional growth.
Oh, it sounds excellent. We'll look forward to that. You want to enter the AI zone with Teresa Worthy? We'll have all of her details in the show notes. And you got a beautiful website and got lots of resources and things available for organizations or individuals. Thank you for sharing some of your insights around emotional intelligence and how it's evolved and inclusivity and how we can make it work and make ourselves better as human beings. All in the effort to make ourselves preferred emotionally and be able to become the emotional favorite in the markets we serve and the people we serve. So yes. I think it goes hand in hand. Teresa, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to meet you.
You too. My pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast is created and associated with Summit Media. My executive producer is Beth Smith and director of research, Tori Smith. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. This podcast is subject to copyright by Summit Media.
Goodbye.